Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the meteoric fall of the United States under Donald Trump from the world power that dominated the G20 to something of a joke on the world stage, where the daughter of a president known for her clothing line sits in between the British and Chinese leaders on an important meeting for her father, who has managed to isolate the US from the rest of the G19 in less than 6 months. Charles Kupchan, who was the director of European Affairs on the National Security Council during the Clinton administration and spent the last 3 years as special assistant to President Obama for national security, joins us to discuss the much-anticipated meeting between Putin and Trump that was conducted in secret without Trump's national security advisor or his National Security Council's Russian-speaking expert present. Then we'll examine the two separate foreign policies the U.S. appears to have, one conducted by the Trump family and the other by a compromised, hamstrung, and largely ignored defense, intelligence, and diplomatic establishment that fringe ideologues inside the White House close to the president, like Stephen Bannon and Sebastian Gorka, refer to as the deep state. A CIA Middle East veteran, Robert Baer, who is now the National Security Affairs Analyst on CNN, joins us to discuss the unprecedented nature of having a leader of the United States trash his own intelligence services on foreign soil while defending the actions of an adversary who attacked the United States. Then finally, we'll get an update on the latest revelations coming from the many investigations into the Trump campaign's possible collusion with Russians following a story in the New York Times that Trump's son-in-law met with a Russian lawyer close to the Kremlin who led the Kremlin's campaign to destroy the late Sergei Magnitsky's investigation into high-level corruption. An expert on international money laundering, James Henry, an economist, lawyer, and investigative journalist who is the co-founder of DCReports.org, joins us to look into whether Trump's former mob-connected partner, Felix Sater, has ratted him out. And joining us now is Charles Kupchan, who was director for European Affairs on the National Security Council during the Clinton administration. He is now a professor of international affairs at Georgetown University School for Foreign Service and spent the last 3 years as a special assistant to President Obama for national security. Welcome to Background Briefing, Charles Kupchan.
Glad to be with you, Ian.
And I must say, reading Saturday's New York Times front page, where the headline was, "The once dominant U.S. Over the G20 is now isolated," it just sort of struck me and really depressed me. I mean, I imagine as a practitioner of U.S. foreign policy, being the, in effect, the National Security Council liaison to Europe during both the Clinton administration and the last 3 years of the Obama administration, how did it strike you?
Well, it is. Very disheartening because one president after another since Pearl Harbor has invested in a trusting, open, transparent relationship with our democratic European allies. And since Trump has taken over the Oval Office, he seems to be trying to turn the world back into something that resembles each country for its own, no special relationships with partners, no difference between a democratic ally like the Chancellor of Germany, Angela Merkel, and Vladimir Putin. And so twice now he's gone to Europe in the space of about a month, first time to NATO and to a G7 meeting. He comes home and he pulls out of the Paris Climate Agreement, and Angela Merkel says, "So much for our long-standing friend, Europe is going to have to take its destiny into its own hands." And then he goes to Hamburg this weekend for the G20, sets the United States apart, 19 versus 1 on Paris Climate Agreement, and again seems to have done much more to damage America's image and credibility in the eyes of European allies, elites and public alike. Our reputation in Europe has plummeted by dozens and dozens of points since Obama left and Trump has arrived.
But the G19 isolating the U.S. Over the Paris Accords, that's not just Europe, is it? That's China, Japan, Mexico, a whole bunch of countries.
Well, when the United States decided to pull out of that agreement, there were only two countries, Syria and Nicaragua, that that were already holdouts. So you're right to say that it was the Chinese and the Russians and just about every other major country in the world, plus another, 180, 195 countries. So we are not just isolated among our democratic allies. We are isolated among just about every country in the world.
So let's turn to the meeting that took place, much anticipated meeting between Trump and Putin. What was extraordinary to me was that the National Security Advisor, General McMaster, was not present. It was only the Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, who has close ties already to Putin and the Kremlin, and Donald Trump and the translators, and Sergei Lavrov, Russia's foreign minister, and Vladimir Putin. Fiona Hill, the Russian-speaking specialist on the National Security Council, who a lot of people were happy to know that she was there in that White House. I heard the head of RT, Russia Today, in an interview, I think it was yesterday, referring to her as saying it was a great thing that Fiona Hill wasn't at that meeting because she's a hawk. Now, I don't know whether Putin vetoed her or what, but why not have your National Security Council, National Security Advisor, and your Russian specialist in on that meeting? It makes no sense to me.
It doesn't make much sense to me either. I think that the Trump team might say that they wanted to keep it small to ensure a frank discussion and to prevent leaks. The more people in the room, the more likely it is that the conversation gets repeated to the press. But it strikes me as very odd that the National Security Advisor, who is supposed to be the person that coordinates foreign policy across the agencies, was not in the room. It is a stunning vote of no confidence in the president's right-hand man, General McMaster. And it makes it extremely difficult for him to do his job because he doesn't know what was said. And then Fiona Hill ought to be there because she's the expert. That she was not there, again, suggests very, very significant dysfunction within the upper reaches of the White House. Now, you could say that it's important for Trump and for Putin to get to know each other and maybe to have a tete-a-tete, and that's all fine. But what they should have done is had a serious meeting with the experts in the room, and then Mr. Trump could have said, I would like 5 or 10 minutes with Mr. Putin. I saw President Obama do that repeatedly, and then he could raise sensitive issues or whatever else he wanted to do. But to have a two-hour-plus bilateral meeting without the National Security Advisor and without the main Russia expert suggests to me that it's just one big mess inside the Trump administration.
Right, but couldn't it also suggest, Charles Kupchan? It suggests to me almost like these are two mob bosses meeting, a secret meeting. This is not how heads of state operate, is it?
Generally, no. If he wanted to have a very sensitive discussion about Russian interference in the U.S. election or some financial issue, and he wanted to keep it private, then you step off. You go into the corner. You have a one-on-one. But this was a meeting where Ukraine was discussed, where Syria was discussed, where the big issues of the day are discussed. And it's very odd that the president's top advisors were not there. And again, it says to me that, either Trump is hiding something or he simply doesn't trust the people that he's hired as his top advisors.
And again, I'm speaking with Charles Kupchan, who was director for European Affairs on the National Security Council during the Clinton administration, is now a professor of international affairs at Georgetown University's School of Foreign Service and spent the last 3 years as special assistant to President Obama for national security. So in effect, Charles Kupchan, we just have to take Rex Tillerson's word for it, what went on in this meeting. I'm not suggesting in any way that Rex Tillerson is not trustworthy, but still, you know, he can spin it any way he likes, can't he?
Yes, and I mean, that's always the case when you have high-level meetings. Oftentimes, we don't know what goes on because the people do their job and they don't speak to the press, and that's fine. That's all good and well. So I'm less troubled that we don't have a good readout in public than I am by the fact that on the one side you had Putin and Lavrov, 80-plus years of experience, pros, known for being savvy, if not downright duplicitous. And on our side, we had two businessmen who combined have a total of about 4 or 5 months of expertise in international affairs. It ain't a level playing field. It doesn't make sense to do business that way.
And what about the idea that the president's daughter, who's known for her clothing line, sits in between the British and Chinese leader on a forum about Africa, and her father went off to do another meeting? My sense from what I'm reading from the European press and the world press, we're becoming something of a joke.
You know, there is a protocol in the G20, and it applies across all large meetings, the G7, the NATO, North Atlantic Council, that when the principal needs to get up, and it could be to go to the bathroom, it could be to take a phone call, it could be to go to a meeting, that someone else takes the chair. But that someone else is usually not a member of the family. It is either the Secretary of State or the Secretary of Defense or the National Security Advisor. So it was extremely odd and I think probably insulting to the other leaders that when President Trump gets up, his daughter takes the chair rather than someone who is seen as not necessarily equal to the president, because there is no one equal to the president, but someone of cabinet rank.
Well, I think it's insulting to the Africans, isn't it?
It's insulting to everybody.
Right.
And it makes the United States look like a kind of mafia-run country where the Don gets up and then one of his family sits down. Even if Ivanka Trump is a trusted advisor, and I gather she is, and I gather her husband is, it doesn't look right, and the Trump White House should be more mindful of the message that it is sending to allies.
But the working session that we're talking about at the G20 was called Partnership with Africa, Migration and Health. And we know that the Chinese have made tremendous inroads into Africa, and they've stolen a march on any other country, including the United States. So my sense is that this is yielding the field, is it not?
Well, in general, I think the Trump administration has handed to the Chinese on a silver platter greater sway over international affairs. One of the first actions that Trump took was to cancel the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which was a multi-country, very ambitious trade deal that had taken years to put together and would have put the United States at the center of the East Asian economy. It had geopolitical implications. We basically just shut down and said, here, China, you guys run the show. Then we pull out of the Paris Climate Agreement, with the United States and China being the two largest emitters. And so now suddenly it is the Chinese that are in the driver's seat. And when the G20 and Merkel and others are looking around for who do we go to, who's going to be the main interlocutor on climate change and on free trade and on investment in Africa, it's going to be China. And so this whole question of American leadership and America's role in the world, it's not just that we're not present and accounted for. We're actually doing things that are helping others step into the gap.
So do you think then, Charles Kupchan, that progressives and liberals in this country are delusional in taking comfort from the idea that there are a couple of adults in the room in this administration, General Mattis and General McMaster, particularly given what just happened to General McMaster not being included in this meeting between Putin and Trump. I mean, we know, for example, that these two fringe ideologues in the White House who are close to Trump, Stephen Bannon and Sebastian Gorka, not only do they refer to defense intelligence and the diplomatic establishment as the deep state. Bannon himself has already vowed to destroy what he calls the regulatory state. There is this sense that you've got within the very heart of the U.S. government this kind of use a medical term, they're burrowing in, and their role is to literally not just upset the status quo, but to almost reverse the status quo, if not destroy both the deep state and the regulatory state.
I would say that I was hopeful, and maybe I should use the word naive, that Tillerson and Mattis and McMaster and Mnuchin and others that have an impressive experience were going to corral Trump and drag him into the mainstream. My hopefulness has now turned into despair. And it wasn't so much this trip that did it. It was the last trip, because trips force presidents to make decisions about policy and about language and about speeches. And that's because, on such and such a day, at such and such an hour, the president has to get up in Warsaw, Poland, or Hamburg, and he's got to publicly state what he thinks. And so what we saw on that trip and on this trip is, as you described, essentially a victory for the hard line. And after the last trip, McMaster, with one of his colleagues, Gary Cohn, in the National Economic Council, published an op-ed where they basically said, we don't believe in multilateralism. We don't believe in an international community. It's each state out for itself. It was basically a Bannon-esque view of a very dangerous world where the United States is just going to be looking out for its back and no one else's. And I do fear that view has now won out. There will be good days when McMaster and others have a little more influence, but I think in general, President Trump has made a decision that he is going to, when in doubt, lean toward Bannon, lean toward being a disruptor. And, you and I look at this last 3 or 4 days, and we think it's a disaster, because he's alienated everyone. He's turned everything upside down. He's pulled out of Paris. He says he's not going to abide by free trade agreements. And we're thinking, holy moly, he's bringing the house down. And his voter base says, this is great. This is what we elected him to do. He's challenging the mainstream. He's challenging the conventional wisdom. And I think that's why he's doing this. He's getting positive feedback from the folks that still support him, and I fear that we're going to have 4 years of this.
Well, just in closing, Bob Baer will be joining us in a minute, but I wanted to ask you about the question I wanted to ask him, which is, how do you react to the idea of the leader of the United States trashing his own intelligence services on foreign soil while defending the actions of an adversary who attacked the United States?
Well, he's been trashing the intelligence agencies for quite a while now, and he came as close as he's come in Warsaw at a press conference when he said, yeah, maybe the Russians did it, maybe they interfered in our elections, but who knows? Could have been anybody. And so the bottom line is that he's going to continue to sow doubt, obfuscate, use smoke and mirrors on this issue. We don't know what went on in that meeting. Apparently, Trump did press Putin, and Putin denied it, and maybe Trump is going to leave it at that. but certainly the congressional investigators and Mr. Mueller are not going to leave it at that. And so I hope that we eventually get to the bottom of exactly what the Russians did during our election season and what, if any, type of cooperation or coordination there was with the Trump campaign.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Charles Kupchan.
My pleasure, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Charles Kupchan, who was Director for European Affairs on the National Security Council during the Clinton administration and is now a professor of international affairs at Georgetown University School of Foreign Service. And he spent the last 3 years as a special assistant to President Obama for national security. We're going to take a brief station break and back examining the two separate foreign policies the U.S. appears to have, one conducted by the Trump family and the other by what Stephen Bannon and Sebastian Gorka refer to as the deep state.
He's a real nowhere man, sitting in his nowhere land, making all his nowhere plans for nobody. Doesn't have a point of view, knows not where he's going to. Isn't he a bit like you?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Robert Baer, one of the most accomplished agents in CIA history and the winner of the Career Intelligence Medal. He's the author of 4 New York Times bestsellers, including See No Evil and Sleeping with the Devil, How Washington Sold Our Soul for Saudi Crude. He's considered one of the world's foremost authorities on the Middle East and is the current National Security Affairs Analyst for CNN. And his latest book is The Perfect Kill, 21 Laws for Assassinations. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Baer.
Thanks, Ian.
So how do you, I just asked Charles Kupchan the same question, how did you respond to this unprecedented situation of having, in Poland, having the leader of the United States trash his own intelligence services on foreign soil while defending the actions of an adversary who attacked the United States?
Well, as you said, it's unprecedented. There's no occasion that I know where a president of the United States has sided with an adversary like Russia. I mean, sort of the last time this happened was, you know, Franco's Spain and Hitler. I mean, I just find this, as a former intelligence officer, incredible that a president would do this. Essentially, the FBI and the CIA work for the president. Both those institutions have come forward with evidence that it was the Russians and the Russians alone who hacked the elections for the benefit of Trump. He goes overseas, meets Putin, trashes in public in Warsaw, the CIA and FBI, meets Putin, and accepts his assurances. I've just never seen anything like it. It was sort of like if FDR went to Tokyo and you know, accepted the assurance of the Japanese they hadn't attacked Pearl Harbor. And I look at this attack, this hacking attack, is equivalent of Pearl Harbor, maybe worse than Pearl Harbor. At least Pearl Harbor united Americans. But this attack is dividing them and it's undermining our democracy.
So what did you think of the meeting itself, though? Because it seemed to me that the meeting between Trump and Putin was kind of like a couple of mafia dons meeting in secret. When no notes were taken, he didn't have his national security advisor, who seems to have been cut off at the knees now, General McMaster. He didn't have Fiona Hill in there, his national security council Russian specialist who speaks Russian, etc. So, I mean, what did you make of it?
Well, I take it at a more basic level, Ian, and he's in effect rewarding Putin for the attack in 2016. Diplomatic usage is that once a country, its relations have deteriorated to this point or should have deteriorated, you don't meet the head of state in a public meeting, not a public meeting, but meet for photographs and reward him and give Russia any legitimacy at all. There's no attempt to to hold Russia accountable, you know, and probably retaliate. And instead, let's say this, let this, you know, put this in the past. What we're offering the Russians is an opportunity to go after elections in 2018, 2020, and right now it looks like they're getting into our nuclear facilities. They're sending probes in, so they continue to hack. And you look on top of it, and the best guess right now is these components for that North Korean ICBM came out of Russia. So to look at Russia as a friendly state, to propose a cybersecurity unit working with the KGB, I mean, this does not even touch, you know, any reason, sense, or normality at all.
Well, but the Russian press are just crowing over this meeting. This was like 2.25 hours, and Melania came in towards the end, and Putin was completely, you know, had his tongue out. He was so, you know, in awe of the Slovakian or Slovenian beauty, etc. That's the part of it that I don't understand. You're right, this guy got rewarded. None of the other G20, G19 people got anything like that treatment. The Australian guy had to beg for a ride in the car. I mean, it's embarrassing.
You know, and then abandoning NATO, abandoning Germany, France, our traditional allies, other democracies, countries that live by the rule of law. And so what he's essentially done is saying, we're going to ally with this autocrat, who also, by the way, happened to assassinate a dissident in London with a weapon of mass destruction, left alpha rays all over London, shot down an airliner, a civilian airliner, invaded the Crimea, and we're saying, you know, it's all past history, let's get over it. It's just amazing. I've never seen anything like it.
And what do you make of the New York Times story that indicates back in June of last year, just after Trump had got the Republican nomination, the son, Donald Jr., the son-in-law Jared, and met with this Russian lawyer who led the attack on Magnitsky, who was investigating Kremlin corruption and ended up being beaten to death in a jail cell. And then, of course, the Magnitsky Act was subsequently passed to sanction those involved. You know, this is who they met with, for God's sake. And the Manafort, of course, set up the meeting. I mean, this is beyond sleaze.
It's cheerful corruption. And Trump didn't have the good sense, once he won the election and got in the White House, to just simply postpone anything to do with Russia or simply gone after him. Anybody with any political sense would have done it. He hasn't. And which makes you go back and wonder whether the Steele report, the dirty dossier, there's a lot of validity to it. I mean, it makes me wonder that there was more than collusion. That something happened in Moscow in 2013, the Russians now believe that they can get away with anything, including, you know, destroying our body politic. I can't see it any other way, because it just makes no sense at all for Trump to even meet Putin in Hamburg and propose intelligence cooperation on the very issue that tipped our elections. What can I say? It's Monty Python.
And again, I'm speaking with Robert Baer, one of the most accomplished agents in CIA history and the winner of the Career Intelligence Medal. He's the author of 4 New York Times bestsellers, including See No Evil and Sleeping with the Devil, How Washington Sold Our Soul for Saudi Crude. He's considered one of the world's foremost authorities on the Middle East and is currently the National Security Affairs Analyst for CNN. And his latest book is The Perfect Kill, 21 Laws for Assassinations. So let's turn to the reason I wanted to talk to you, in effect, was because there appears to be two separate foreign policies at work in the United States, one conducted by the Trump family and the other by a compromised, hamstrung, and largely ignored defense, intelligence, and diplomatic establishment that fringe ideologues inside the White House close to Trump, like Stephen Bannon and Sebastian Gorka, refer to as the deep state. So my sense is that the evidence is stark over Qatar. I mean, Trump goes on television and takes credit for this ill thought out, you know, impetuous, stupid, rash, reckless, and dangerous Saudi move against Qatar. Trump goes on television and takes credit for it, while his own Secretary of State's tearing his hair out, the defense establishment. I don't think Trump even knew that there was a big U.S. base in Qatar. And now you've got, you know, the so-called deep state that Trump and Gawker are trying to trash and undermine. They don't know what to do. I mean, my understanding, you know these people better than I do.
Well, the irony is the deep state is Bannon, Ivanka, Jared, and whoever else is in the middle of this. You don't even know. I don't think the rest of the government knows. I mean, the deep state, they're calling the State Department, the CIA, the FBI, and the Defense Department the deep state. It's as if the deep state, in their eyes, put this base, two bases in Qatar, the two bases that we use for the war on terror, as if this was some sort of, you know, parallel government. It's an ideology that defies any logic. And Bannon's plan to tear down the government to nothing and turn it over to Breitbart, you know, Ian, if I'd proposed a novel about this a couple of years ago, you'd just laugh. You'd say thank you, and you'd hang up the phone. I mean, seriously, we'd be the first country in the world ever to destroy, you know, its State Department, Defense Department. Not even Mao Zedong did that in the Cultural Revolution with the Red Guards. You know, where's this going? What's happening?
Well, we know that the main reason why the families, what they're doing is to do with making money. They've turned the White House into a huge business opportunity. But why then, you know, it'd be okay if they were just stealing the country blind, because a lot of world leaders around the world, that's their primary function. But the idea that not only do you steal the country blind, but you wreck it at the same time. What's the point of that?
Well, I think you have to tear institutions apart to really rob it blind. And they don't really care about hiding it. Ivanka's $100 million from Saudi Arabia is just the tip of the iceberg that Trump cronies got out of this Saudi arms deal, just the tip of the iceberg. And his alliance with Mohammed bin Salman, the de facto king, and Mohammed bin Zayed in the UAE, I mean, they're making money off of it, as you said. And these elections we're going into in 2018, you're going to see more money going to these elections than you could even imagine after Georgia's 6th, which was, what, 20 million or something like went into that?
Well, 50 altogether, yeah.
Yeah, I don't even know what it was. I don't even think people know with the PAC money, with the, you know, the dark money coming in. So you're going to see everybody is collecting money right now to go into these elections. And as we've been talking about, Trump in particular needs to feed these elections in 2018 so he doesn't get impeached. He needs a bulletproof Congress. And if he makes enough money, that's what he's going to get.
And it could be Saudi money, right? It could be anybody's money, right?
Oh, I don't think they care anymore. As we saw with Flynn and everybody else, as soon as Trump was elected, they went, you know, hands out, say, give us money, and U.S. foreign policy is for sale. And they're just going to turn it against the Democrats, and the Democrats do not have a clue what's coming. I mean, I could really see an even more alt-right Congress coming in 2018.
So this idea that the Democrats are sitting around counting on impeachment or this guy choking on a cheeseburger, I mean, they got to get their act together. They're likely to lose this great opportunity that, you know, they keep talking about. All the pundits say, oh, well, you know, always in midterm, the government in power loses seats. Well, you're saying no.
Well, the game has changed.
Yeah.
The game has truly changed. I mean, Colorado in the 3rd District, you can see the money coming in. And within, they can pump into congressional elections here 2, 3, 4, 5 million within weeks through PACs. And you have no idea where it's coming from. And it's about energy projects. But in fact, Washington is about energy projects too, or financial services, you know, deregulation. And with, you know, after Citizens United, there's, you know, we don't know where the money's coming from. And the Democrats will be outspent. And that's just a fact.
Well, I think it's, I've mentioned this before, and it sounds like a conspiracy theory, but it actually is absolutely proven that, in effect, it's not that the plutocrats have bought the U.S. government, that two plutocrats have largely organized the buying of the U.S. government, and that's the two Koch brothers. I mean, this is why the Republicans are having a hard time with this health care bill, is because it's a tax cut bill. And everything they've done so far has been at the behest of the Koch brothers. You know, all of the so-called successes so far of the Trump administration have been opening up offshore drilling, destroying the EPA, bringing in the tar sands oil from Canada, the tax cuts for the rich via the health care bill, and now the big permanent tax cuts that they want, and getting out of the Paris Accords. Everything they've done so far has been the Koch brothers' agenda.
It's the smartest business deal the Koch brothers have ever done, including their polluting refineries. Or even, you know, Father Koch, who made his first money in Nazi Germany, building a refinery for Hitler. It's like nobody cares anymore that that's where they made their money, their first money. Or that they bought the U.S. Congress. And they have fellow travelers, other oil companies. And, you know, they've in fact won.
So is there any chance, do you see any chance of the American people getting organized? Clearly, the Democrats don't see the writing on the wall, and they're somehow counting on impeachment. And Trump's already ahead of them on that. He knows that, that's why he's basically given up his presidency to Paul Ryan. He's no longer a president in the sense of separation of powers. He's totally basically doing what Ryan and company and the Koch brothers want. Because
you look at Trump's populist agenda, and pieces of it made sense. I mean, he called for single payer health care. He says, "I'm going to do better. Everybody's going to have health care." But once he got in and saw how weak he was, you're right. He had to turn to Congress, which is owned by, to oversimplify, the Koch brothers.
Right.
And they have their agenda, and they need a lot. They need a lot, make a lot of money in the next 3 years so that they can go into the next presidential election, along with Mercer and the rest of them, and buy the election. I just don't see any other way. I talk to people in congressional districts who outlined chapter and verse how much money they put in these congressional elections, which oil companies, who was behind it, and what project they wanted to get out of the elections. And if you're spending $4, $5, $6 million for Colorado's third, and you're getting a return of, you know, whatever, $10 million a year, it's a good deal.
Well, and the other irony, of course, is that it looks like this Russian investigation, or the various Russian investigations, are driving Trump further into the hands of the Congress, because he needs them to protect him from impeachment.
Exactly. He's got to give Congress anything it wants and the Koch brothers in order not to end up impeached or in jail.
We're going to be talking in a minute about both that New York Times story about how they met with the son-in-law and the son met with this disgusting Russian lawyer who's responsible for the murder of Magnitsky, who was looking into corruption, as we all
know. Robbing an American company, by the way.
Right.
Cheating the Russian government. It's gangster capitalism, and it's predation like we've never seen, you know, even back in the robber baron era.
Right, and the other story is that we're going to be talking about in a minute is the possibility that the mob-connected former partner of Trump, Felix Sater, has flipped and is ratting on him. Are you following any of that?
I have followed that. I mean, you know, come on, New York construction. You have to go into business with people that don't exactly have sterling reputations. I mean, I know New York City construction. Everybody's in it. So the fact that you know, people are focusing on this, but where does it all lead? Can you get an indictment, the Department of Justice, on Trump, or an impeachment? And I've often been wrong about the future, but I doubt it's coming.
Well, I thank you for joining us, Robert Baer.
Thanks.
And again, I'm your speaker, Robert Baer, one of the most accomplished agents in CIA history and the winner of the Career Intelligence Medal. He's the author of four New York Times bestsellers, including See No Evil and Sleeping with the Devil, How Washington Sold Our Soul for Saudi Crude. He's considered one of the world's foremost authorities on the Middle East and is the current national affairs analyst for CNN. And his latest book is The Perfect Kill, 21 Laws for Assassinations. And we're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back with an update on the latest revelations coming from the many investigations into the Trump campaign's possible collusion with Russians. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now from Johannesburg, South Africa, is James Henry, an economist, lawyer, and investigative journalist, and a former chief economist at McKinsey & Company. He is the Edward R. Murrow Fellow at Tufts University's Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy, an Inspire Fellow at the Institute for Global Leadership at Yale University, and co-founder with David K. Johnston of the new investigative reporting news service, dcreport.org. He was a lead researcher on the Tax Justice Network's report, The Price of Offshore Revisited, and is the author of The Blood Bankers. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Henry.
Glad to be with you. Greetings from Johannesburg.
Thank you, James. And of course, you're in a country that's run by a kleptocrat, right, Jacob Zuma? so you're in ground zero for corruption, right?
Is it time to comment on this?
No. We need the time to talk about these two stories. One in the New York Times that's just out now about Trump's son-in-law and son meeting with this disgusting Russian lawyer who's behind the murder of the late Sergei Magnitsky, who was investigating high-level corruption inside the Kremlin, and also, as Bob Baer just mentioned, a previous guest, also against the U.S. company that they were looting as well. And then, of course, the other one is the report that Trump's former mob-connected partner, Felix Sater, may have ratted him out. So let's start with the Magnitsky story, with that lawyer from the Kremlin lawyer that he met with. What do you know about that? Or do you think that's a solid lead?
Well, there's a lot to know about the Magnitsky case. Basically, this was a case of where some U.S. investors, Armitage was a big fund. Bill Browder.
I'm going to actually have Bill on tomorrow's program, so we don't need to get into that.
But I mean, basically, the from this end, the idea that the Magnitsky was a lawyer working with Browder and recovering about $250 million of stolen assets, and these assets were basically taken by a bunch of people connected to the Russian government, and they were. Basically, long story short, they were laundered and moved abroad. Some of them ended up in New York. Some of the people who handled that are folks who had done business with people like Jared Kushner. So there's a lot to look at with respect to the Magnitsky assets. Unfortunately, just last month, the U.S. Justice Department surprisingly closed a big money laundering case against some of the players in that case. And I know Louise Shelley, who's an expert on the Russian mafia at George Washington University, told me she was called at 4 o'clock on the Friday afternoon to see that, you know, basically the Trump Justice Department had decided to kill the case. So, you know, there's a lot more here to understand about where the money went. And my basic perspective on this whole situation is that, you know, Trump is much more of a mobster than he is a mole. I think he's had relationships with all kinds of shady people, and we should really get down to following the money. And it looks like Mueller is about to do that. A lot of the investigations in Congress and so far were, you know, looking at last year's election, you know, and hoping that there was evidence of Putin's involvement. But from this perspective, you know, this goes back a lot farther than just last year's election. And, you know, Putin may have discovered that he has buyer's regret because this fellow is a little bit harder to control than perhaps someone who was just a mole. Anyway, the Magnitsky case is one of several lines of inquiry now that I think are important. And some of them are also that have been breaking lately. One is involved with the money that's flowing out of Kazakhstan. That's the case involving Sater, where, according to the Financial Times last week, he's decided to become some kind of cooperator with an investigation. But it didn't really specify whether that was an official government investigation or, you know, just a private lawsuit that's been going on regarding a great big bank that was kind of ripped off in Kazakhstan. A lot of the money flew abroad. So, you know, we just don't know. It hasn't been confirmed by Sater's lawyers or by the Justice Department that he is cooperating. He has a history of being a cooperator with the FBI and possibly other agencies, going all the way back to 1998, when in December of 1998, he signed a secret deal with U.S. prosecutors in the Eastern District, including Loretta Lynch and also Andrew Weissman, who's now been appointed to be Mueller's right-hand guy. So Mueller knows Sater very well. I mean, Weissman, his right-hand deputy, surely does. And so that makes me think that Sater may be trying to cut a deal to save himself from jail.
And Sater was... Wasn't he charged with a mafia Ponzi scheme?
Yeah, he was involved in a $40 million fraud, which was involving pumping stocks for four brokerage firms in Manhattan. Right. They were all owned by 19 defendants, most of whom were either Russian or Italian mobsters. And this is one of the tail end of the 90s cases. We've been fighting to get the documents unsealed, most recently just last week in the Second Circuit. There's a bunch of journalists who have banded together and are trying to argue that the First Amendment requires them to unseal some of the documents in this case. And it's amazing that 18 years later, I mean, first of all, it took 13 years for Sater to even have to plead anything in this case. Or at least a decade. I'm sorry, just a decade. So he was able to commit frauds basically secretly during this period. A lot of the deals he did with Trump involving places like the Trump Soho, you know, would not have been feasible if he'd had to tell people he was a convicted felon. So these plea deals really, I think, in the long run, they may have put a few people in jail. I think the average sentence in that case was 1 year. But the longer-term effect was that Trump and Sater got together and did a lot of fraudulent deals. I think that's the big story here.
Sure. And again, I'm speaking with James Henry, an economist, lawyer, and investigative journalist, and the former chief economist at McKinsey & Company. He is the co-founder with David K. Johnson of the new investigative reporting news service, dcreport.org, and is the author of The Blood Bankers. So you mentioned, James Henry, that the Justice Department closed this case. That was to protect Trump, and must have been Sessions' actions there. But what's Mnuchin doing, or more importantly, not doing, in terms of FinCEN, which is the part of the, that's the investigative part of the Treasury that I understand have got tremendous resources, and they really are specialists in tracking dirty money around the world. Is Mnuchin trying to sit on FinCEN to protect Trump?
You know, we don't know. I mean, there were several proposals that are on the agenda for Treasury to have cooperation with respect to tax information. And, you know, those are basically, it looked like they're on hold. The OECD made a lot of proposals about disclosing things like the beneficial ownership of offshore companies, and also, you know, Delaware and Nevada companies. We still don't know who the beneficial owners are of the trusts and companies. That stuff is kind of stuck in limbo. It would be helpful, I think. It's not a magic bullet, but it certainly would be helpful if that kind of data was made available, especially to not only to law enforcement, but also to the journalists who, you know, have the capacity and the will to really ask probing questions that in many cases they're not compromised. So, yeah, I mean, I think the Treasury has a lot on its plate that they have to decide, you know, with respect to the, what extent they're going to continue to preserve the kind of existing financial secrecy that sort of facilitates a lot of this funny business, or to what extent they're going to be much more transparent. I think there's been a lot of progress in the last 5 years in terms of getting Europe to be more transparent. Even countries like Switzerland are beginning to release more data on who owns what. But the U.S. has become, under Trump, I think, following a policy of at least the direction of becoming a tax haven. We want to cut taxes for the rich and, you know, and keep this financial secrecy in place. So that's a real burning issue you don't hear much about in the press these days, but it is an important one to those of us who are journalists working in this area.
So what's your sense, though? I mentioned earlier to our earlier guests that the liberals, progressives, the Democrats in this country seem to be, they don't seem to have a narrative. They don't have a platform. They don't have any leadership. They don't have I mean, they haven't learned anything from Hillary Clinton's defeat, it seems. And basically, all they're doing at the moment is counting on Trump being impeached or maybe choking on a cheeseburger. So do you think that that is, in effect, a trap to count on impeachment?
I do think it's a trap. It's sort of asking for the magic, potion as a solution here. I think the Democrats are still, to some extent, in denial about why they lost the last election. I mean, they'd like to blame it all on Putin. You know, that was partly responsible, but I think there are many other factors involved. But really, they ought to get on with having an agenda of positive programs and proposals for the country on all of these various issues, alternatives, instead of letting Republicans, dominate the conversation. But I think that, you know, there's a real problem of leadership in the Democratic Party. We have Bernie is probably the most popular politician in the country. He's 74 years old. We probably can't count on running him for office in 2020, although some people are hoping he'll live forever. But we do need to think about this concrete idea beyond individuals of having a real positive program as opposed to just, you know, counting on demonizing Trump, because Trump may not be around forever. And a lot of the other people in the party that he represents are, you know, if anything, just as bad. So that's, I think, a problem with the way progressive politics in this country is structured. And, you know, it's not something that's going to be easily resolved. But it's, you know, I think there's more and more focus now on developing really concrete tax proposals, ideas about carbon taxes that can be progressive taxes, proposals to have deployment of smart grid technology that helps people save on the carbon that they're doing. I think these are a lot of bright ideas that progressives can come up with doesn't have a party stamp on them, but it's really important for us to focus on these positive proposals for the country.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, then, just getting back to the inquiry, and so just tell us what you think is likely to happen here in terms of whether there is a money laundering case against Trump or something else crops up from these various investigations. But just in the context of the fact that, in effect, the Russian investigations have driven Trump into the hands of the Congress, which is largely controlled by the Koch brothers. So he needs the Congress to protect him because it's the Congress who brings forth impeachment. So it looks like with unlimited money, Trump could actually win. The Republicans could actually win the midterms and maintain control of the Congress. And in effect, we don't even have a president anymore. He's totally surrendered to the House. So that's the way I see things at the moment.
Yeah. I think that's a pretty pessimistic situation. I'm here in South Africa where there's also a lot of gloom and doom. The one thing you learn from South Africa, for example, is not to underestimate the capacity of people to come together and do the right thing. So I think that, yes, the Congress has dropped the ball in terms of the investigation. I mean, it's been very hard to get the Republicans on board. It's not clear what Mueller is really going to come up with or, you know, how long it's going to take. I think it's still going to be up to journalists at the end of the day to keep on breaking open stories here. So that's what I'm trying to do. But I think don't mourn, organize. That's what some famous progressives have said. Get up and go out and organize ordinary people and make them aware of these situations. Because I think when you explain these realities to people, it doesn't matter who they voted for in the last election. They're surprised and shocked. And I just impressed with the tremendous capacity of the American people to really wake up here. And we'll see. You know, there's Koch brothers, but, you know, their arguments do not stand up under analysis. That's our weapon. That's the only weapon we have, really. So that's what makes me more optimistic than not.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, James Henry.
Good. Thanks. Good.
Thanks a lot, Jim. And again, I've been speaking with James Henry, who's an economist, lawyer, and investigative journalist, and the former chief economist at McKinsey and Company. He's an Edward R. Murrow Fellow at Tufts University's Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy, an Inspire Fellow at Yale's Institute for Global Leadership, and co-founder with David K. Johnson of the new investigative reporting news service DCReports.org. And he was the lead investigator on the Tax Justice Network's report, The Price of Offshore Revisited, and is the author of The Blood Bankers. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.